Page 94, the Private Eye podcast.
Hello and welcome to Page 94. Andrew Hunter-Murray has retreated to his summer dasher, so I've staged a mutiny and, as in any good coup, taken control of the broadcaster. I'm Helen Lewis, a writer for Private Eye, and I'm joined by Adam McQueen and Ian Hislop to discuss some stories that have broken since our last print issue. Adam, let's start with you. We're making a habit of kind of big beast middle-aged male columnist monthly over here, but tell me about what Jeremy Clarkson has been up to.
I was worried that I was the middle-aged big beast here, but okay, I'll take that. Yes, Jeremy Clarkson. In the incredibly slow way that these things were, remember that column he wrote about Meghan Markle way back in November last year? It's taken, where are we at now, 7 months for IPSO, the press regulator, to respond to that record number of complaints, some 25,000 complaints, and come up with a judgment, which is pretty much the judgment that Jeremy Clarkson made himself the next morning when he looked at his Twitter feed and realised quite what a cock-up he had made of things.
So it was basically, the problem was he said he hated her on a cellular level, she should be paraded through the streets naked and pelted with rubbish, and that he also hated Nicola Sturgeon and Rose West.
Yes, those were the key things, and those are the things that were picked up.
I hate to pick you up on the detail, it was pelted with excrement.
All right. Okay, good.
Not rubbish. It was a very key
specific
scene in Game of Thrones.
But he said that because he'd written it so quickly, he forgot to mention that he was riffing on Game of Thrones. Right? This was his entirety of his defence. Was that?
It was pretty much that, wasn't it? Yeah, yeah. That actually, it's okay if you want women to be taken through the streets and naked and pelted with excrement, as long as you reference a popular TV show, which is in itself no way hideously misogynistic and unpleasant.
Well, that's all the Game of Thrones fans gone, Adam. Thank you very much.
Sure. I never watched it.
No, it's fine. The last season and the weird dragon, they've all gone off it. You're fine. Everyone's evacuated.
Less of the they, but it's more of a we over here.
Oh, really?
He's a nerd. Sorry.
I mean, this was the biggest complaint that IPSO had ever had, right? 25,000 people wrote to IPSO.
It was an extraordinary number of people, but this is where some of the oddity comes into it. So IPSO, traditionally, and certainly the PCC before them, always said they can only take complaints from people who are directly affected by this. And Meghan Markle does not appear to have been one of, or in fact, explicitly is not one of the people who made a complaint about it. IPSO have decided they can act because two of those complaints came from two representative groups, one of which was the Fawcett Society, and one of which was Wild.
The Wild Foundation.
The Wild
so the Fawcett Society is a pretty well-established women's campaigning group named after Millicent Garrett Fawcett, the suffragist. I'd not previously heard of the Wild Foundation. I like to think they're in the spirit of Oscar Wilde, and their main objection was it wasn't very funny.
I did wonder that, no, but in fact it's a charity supporting women and girls who are survivors of domestic abuse, who made a separate complaint about the article. And they complained that it breached a number of different clauses. Clause 12, discrimination. Clause 3, harassment. And clause 1, accuracy. Now, that 3 and 1... IPSO said, no, you're not getting a chance on that one, that doesn't count. And that it would have been slightly odd had they been got on clause 1 for accuracy, because there always has been this traditional split when it comes to press regulation of opinion pieces where you're allowed to be as rude and unpleasant as you want to be, and news pieces where you've got to kind of get at least some of the facts right.
Ian, can I ask you a question that's going to upset you, which
yes.
is, would you like to defend Jeremy Clarkson? But hold on here. But
yes.
Because we had this discussion about judicial reviews, which is the same question about the idea of who's got standing and should anyone be able to basically start legal actions or, in this case, complaints to the regulator?
I mean, as an editor, the idea that anyone can complain in an article, even if it's not about them, I think is a bit worrying, which is why I was originally very sympathetic to the idea that if you want to complain to the regulator about a piece about yourself, you should complain yourself. And if 25,000 people complain that this is hideous, that is a big backup. But the initial complaint saying, I have been badly treated by the press, should come from you. Now, the problems about IPSO, one of the reasons I don't belong, I didn't belong to the body before that, I haven't belonged to any press regulation body, and I told Lord Leveson this, and we had an interesting discussion.
How did he take that?
Well, given that he just said that Private Eye was the only reliable publication covering the Leveson inquiry, he couldn't then say, well, then I should join up with the others and they should take a view on me from my peers. So I'm in an odd position here in the sort of very old-fashioned quis custodiet ipsos custodes juvenile quote. I feel that part of the function of Private Eye and the Street of Shame is to look at the other papers rather than have them look at me and say, no, we don't like you. So that for me is a slight problem. But I looked at the clause about you're allowed to be mean-spirited and cruel, tasteless and offensive, and I thought, good, because I think that is quite important. And the problem with the Clarkson piece is not that it's those things, but it is consistently attacking Meghan Markle for being a woman.
Mm.
because he talks about bedroom tactics, and it's sort of, he immediately decided that it wouldn't do and apologised for it.
Well, this is the problem that now we have this kind of... So there's a full page in this morning's Telegraph, recording this on Monday, from Fraser Nelson, the editor of The Spectator, saying this is a terrible turn of affairs and a terrible defeat for freedom of speech and a dark day for the press. And it's an odd hill to die on, given that both Clarkson and The Sun backed down immediately and said that the article was completely wrong and should never have been printed.
But there has been a strange thing that's happened to Jeremy Clarkson since, hasn't there, Adam? This sort of feeling where he's tried to do lots of articles where he's gone, do you know who loves diversity?
He's the new Jezza, isn't he? Yeah. I was trying to think what it is that actually sums up the article since. It's basically, when will my kids start talking to me again, isn't it? Because his daughter, Emily, was extremely cross. She made a public statement not quite disowning her father, but certainly disowning that column and saying that she was disgusted by it. And he has been. We've got the new sensitive Jezza now, haven't we? We've had pieces on trans rights, and we had one yesterday in his Sunday Times column, which was about how awful rich people are, and really he's not quite kind of going out and sitting on the streets with Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion, but he's kind of going in that direction.
I mean, he apologised straight away for this. I mean, he once appeared on Have I Got News For You, and I said something mildly mean-spirited, cruel, tasteless, offensive, but not discriminatory about him. And he threw a biro at me, which punctured my cheek, and I started bleeding quite profusely, and we had to stop the recording. Jeremy, at that point, said, it's not bleeding, it's red biro, he's making the whole thing up. And then we did have to stop and then continue. And then a few weeks later, I got a card from him saying, my wife says I should apologise to you. So I think Meghan has done pretty well getting an apology out of Jeremy. I mean, straight away.
I think I've got the solution here, because one of the odd things about this is that column went through. Not only did Jeremy Clarkson, as you said, kind of toss it off. No, that's the wrong phrase to use, isn't it?
Thank you.
Write it in haste without checking over it. But it was then sent into The Sun, where it was published by The Sun, who have a female editor, a female chief executive of the publishing company, both of whom are enormously active in the organisation Women in Journalism. No one appeared to notice this at all. Well, clearly, everything needs to be run past either Jeremy's wife, or ex-wife, as I think she is now, and daughter Emily, just to kind of keep an eye on him. A bit like Caleb does on the farm.
I have to say, much my beloved Clarkson's farm, his girlfriend Lisa is an absolute terror, and I think probably has bred him the right act too, and he's probably had to go and do some manure spreading in penance. So maybe it's all worked out for the best. Well, let's move on now to another press story, which I think I've been following because of my personal interest very carefully. It's whether or not a child has or has not been identifying as a cat. Now, Adam, give me the view that you gave in the magazine last week. Tell me a bit about the kind of way that this was misreported by the right.
So this was the tape of to pupils at Rye College, which was reported universally to start with as a classmate of theirs was identifying as a cat. Although actually, when you listen to the tape, it was a bit unclear because they also mentioned identifying as a cow as well. But the cat was the one that everyone kind of went with. There were all sorts of other issues which came up on that tape, and the college said that the teacher in question could have handled things better. But this, obviously, the most extreme thing is the one that the tabloids are going to go for. It was amazing to see kind of Fleet Street in full flow for a fortnight, desperately trying to find any child anywhere or any parent who would say that their child actually identified as a cat. The Daily Mail ran a full double-page spread investigation, which they managed to find someone who said that a friend of theirs at school put cat ears on at lunchtime but didn't wear them in the classroom. That was as hardcore as the investigation got. So, it turned out... I mean, and the extraordinary thing about it is when it's entirely circular. This was a story that was an urban myth that's been circulating in America in 2022. It kind of came over here in January. There were a couple of other schools, I think one down in the Isle of Wight and one up in near Aberdeen, that were accused of it at different times.
Right, and it got wrapped in with a panic about... Sorry, and this is too delicate for your ears, but about furries, and I'm sure you're intimately acquainted with them. But the idea of people who like to dress up in... animal costumes and indulge in a practical yiffing, which is having sex with each other while dressed as animals. So there is already an thriving. Sorry, I know you're looking at me like I'm
just thinking,
nuts.
Are there any other podcasts here that go from quoting juvenile in the original Latin to defining yiffing?
All human life is.
Yeah, don't get this from No Such Thing as a Fish, do you?
Right, but so there is an established internet subculture of people, and the question has always been, you know, are some people within that, do they take it a bit far? And then they also say, actually, I think inside in some way I feel a spiritual affinity with a cat. And what does that even mean? But I mean, you wrote the joke this week about the fact that these children are identifying as piss takers, right?
when I read a lot of journalism, I often think, have you ever met anyone? And in this case, I thought, have you ever met any children? And then Adam made me listen to the recording. And all I could think of was, these are exactly the children taking the piss out of their teacher. They're working out how to wind her up, and they succeeded. And she lost it. But listening to the tape, I did not feel an overwhelming sense of moral panic. I felt, I think, these two children, I'm very glad I'm not their teacher, but they successfully got her goat. But what wasn't happening in that tape was a discussion about cats. It's easy for picture editors to find a picture of a child dressed up as a cat. A cow is slightly harder work. So we went to the cat. And much easier for everyone, I would guess, not to consider what they were talking about at all.
That was my feeling. Is it was also, but you covered very well, Adam, I think, how it was misreported on the right. I think there was a column in The Guardian by Nesrine Malik that said, this story's not true. And then very briefly about Halfway Down, it said, actually, the way that the teacher was talking about gender was a bit unhelpful. Mm. And I think that's what the thing that lots of people were trying to raise was that the kids said they believe there are only two genders. Well, whether or not you disagree with that, that's, you know, it's certainly not a scientific fact that can be taught one way or another, right? It's a matter of kind of opinion and belief. And then they also said, you know, various things about they just believe that men have got penises and women have got vaginas, and the teacher called them then despicable and suggested they needed to move schools. And that is a bit worrying, because I think this is, I do agree with you, there is an element of moral panic, but I think it builds upon the fact that parents are worried about what fashionable things about gender that have only really kind of taken hold in the last 10 years are being presented to their children. So I was very in favour of the schools bringing compulsory sex and relationships education, which happened in 2020. But some of that has been farmed out by overworked schools and underfunded schools to private providers. And Ken McDonald said, racist last year, the fact that it's quite hard to actually do freedom of information requests and find out what is in this teaching, what your kids are being taught, because they will say commercial confidentiality, we can't kind of tell you.
This is the classic outsourcing defence, isn't it? It doesn't seem to matter what sector or what subject. As soon as people do something that you want to know about, they say, well, it's commercial.
And I think we don't want to go down the route of America, and you're right, in places like Florida and Texas, this has become a huge, huge issue with various sort of parents groups, which are often kind of fronts for extreme right politics, you know, demanding to see the curriculum and go through, and actually then becoming kind of overtly homophobic too. I just think a bit of transparency about what was actually being told, and maybe a kind of certain sense of limitation about how much it is schools' kind of purview to teach some of this stuff might help dial the temperature down.
Well, there were Islamic groups protesting in this country about you know, the primary school sex education curriculum. So it's not just in the States, is it?
No.
I mean, parents do want to get involved, but I suppose what they're saying in this case is this is all very, very new. It's been outsourced to someone we don't know anything about. Could we know?
Yeah, and I think the whole thing is a giant failure of politics, because as you say, there is a faction within the Tory party that absolutely loves this stuff, doesn't necessarily want to talk about inflation, be very happy to talk about woke madness, TM. And then the faction, the Labour Party, that finds this incredibly uncomfortable to talk about, and therefore would rather just say, oh, it's all Tory nonsense. And so you get an absence of moderate voices in the centre. And then everybody, you know,
it's not even just an absence of moderate voices in the centre, is it? It's an absence of talking about the actual key issues in it at all, because instead, always the coverage is going to go off into the extremes and the entrenched positions on both sides, and whether or not people are identifying as cats or not. It's letting down everyone, really.
Ian, I wanted to ask you about putting Russia on the cover last week.
Yes.
By the time you sent that to press, the kind of everybody had been very excited. There's a coup. There's definitely going to be a coup. Oh no, there's not a coup. How did you decide that was going to be a story that you thought would kind of keep going, or do you just find it very funny?
What I found funny about it was the fact that no one knew anything about it, and we have swathes of academics and press experts and Russophiles and people who go to conferences, and no one knew anything. And we ended up running a joke, which was actually Adam's, which was just sort of hundreds of columnists had to stop after they'd been forced into a humiliating U-turn. And what's interesting about the coverage since we put that cover on is a lot of them have said, we don't know what's going on.
Steve Rosenberg, the BBC's guy in Moscow, is obviously very good, but I've been really surprised by the domestic press's just absence of kind of expertise or being able... I mean, I guess reporting from Russia is obviously, for technical reasons, very difficult, but no one is leaking. I'm very upset.
and, you know, in the middle of the day, you're saying, well, the coup failed because the Russians had kidnapped all of Prigozhin's family. And he'd given in to blackmail. And then that story disappeared. So he thought, well, was that one at all true? And then they said he'd been bought off. And I thought, Is there that much money left in Russia to buy him off? And then his own mercenaries are furious with him, or they're not, and they're going with him. And why isn't he dead anyway?
Yes, that was the thing that most surprised me, is what does Vladimir Putin think he's going to do in Belarus? Just hang around, just, you know,
not eat sushi and stay away from high windows, I would imagine.
Right, but just, you know, just chill out, maybe have an allotment, something like that, something nice. It just seemed a bit, the whole thing seems very peculiar. Adam, before we move on, I want to ask you another press-related question, which is, do you have any super injunctions out at the moment?
Do I have any?
Just if you wanted to confess.
I haven't really got the cash to take out a super injunction. They're very much the preserve of the rich and famous. No, super injunctions, amazingly. So there is a standard rule. It used to be that if someone told you that a story was not being reported because there was a D notice, they were talking nonsense. Nowadays, if someone tells you with great confidence, particularly on Twitter, there is a super injunction about this, there isn't. There was a spate of super injunctions in around 2010, 2011, where the courts got were kind of whacking them out all over the place. And very famously, a lot of them exposed. Trafigura, of course, was the big one, but there were all sorts of other ones. How would Donald Trump take that? That's the one that everyone's forgotten about and his affair. There were quite a few Ryan Giggs, football fans. No, there were a good few of them.
The only thing that Howard Donald needs to cover up now is his Twitter likes, because he did, you know?
Oh, I did see that, yes.
He got hoofed off a Pride parade for having liked some fairly spicy gender critical tweets, but then you looked at the other ones and it was sort of David Icke, and you think someone's had a tough lockdown, Howard.
Super injunctions, just to explain, are the ones you're not even allowed to know about. They're not even like anonymized injunctions. They're the ones that no one is allowed to report the fact that even anyone has taken legal action to stop themselves appearing in the paper. They are absolutely tip-top secret. So we don't really get those anymore, because Master Rawls did this thing where he said, essentially, there are almost no circumstances under which one of these should be put out, and quite right too. What we do get, although decreasingly over the last few years, we've hardly had any of them in a while, is your standard anonymized injunction. So these are the kind of the alphabet soup, your TFDs versus DFTs. But amazingly, last week, we've got another one. It feels like old days. We haven't had one of these in ages. It's WFZ versus BBC, but in this case, it's less of a mystery, the alphabet soup, because BBC does actually stand for British Broadcasting Corporation. Now, the nature of this, because it's all anonymised and it's saying that we're not allowed to say anything, is we can't go into enormous detail on it.
It's essentially someone who's been accused of, in fact, arrested for serious sexual offences, and the BBC wanted to report that within the context of saying that the industry in which they work is very bad at dealing with these complaints, right?
It is, yeah. And it's an interesting one. There's a really interesting point in this, because it's going into this whole very unclear area in the law, and the judgment actually makes this clear at the moment, which is, are we allowed to report the fact that people have been arrested? Are we allowed to report the fact that people are being investigated by the police? And where does it lie? And there have been all sorts of precedent. Famously, the Cliff Richard case, where it was the BBC in that case, when they sent the helicopter up for the police raid, turned out to be absolutely nothing to it. And he got an enormous amount of money out of the BBC and from the relevant police force at the time for their involvement in tipping off journalists about it. But also, it was used almost immediately then by Rolf Harris. He sent out letters from Carterfuck, our favourite solicitors. He sent out letters on behalf of Rolf Harris saying that you are not allowed to report that he is being investigated or has been arrested. And look how that case turned out.
So when he was actually charged, convicted and jailed, it sort of solved itself, really.
It falls down at that point, doesn't it? Yeah.
I can see the argument for, not a privacy argument, but a contempt argument, saying, you know, you're messing up this court case, and journalism, we think we're unbelievably important in nearly all matters. But if the police are pursuing a case and our involvement is likely to mess it up, I do get that. I mean, I have been on the wrong side of various of these arguments over the years, a certain amount of contempt on my record. But correct me if I'm wrong, Adam, the argument here is the claimant wants a privacy ruling.
Yes, and that is increasing. I mean, privacy law is kind of evolving with every judgment and being used in different ways.
The bit that made me slightly more reassured about this was the fact that the BBC had, in the judgment, it says the BBC had planned to contextualise this allegation. It wasn't that they just merely wanted to report the arrest. It was that they wanted to use the arrest as kind of illustrative of a problem within a sector. And the judge said that risks making the claimant the kind of poster person, basically, for this entire problem. So I know what you mean, though. I was very surprised, and it kind of speaks to the fact that this is an unclear and evolving area of law, that I had thought that if there is an arrest, and that's, you know, that is a formal police matter. But, well, I know, don't we'll refer... We like to go doing our kind of legal corner, so hopefully... We do, yes.
Keeps Robin, our lawyer, busy when he listens to these.
Let's just talk a little bit about some incredibly fraught and contested bits of law.
So, I mean, this week's podcast is mostly about things you're not allowed to report or say, or that you might get an inquiry into. That's very, very reassuring.
On that note, I'm going to say goodbye, and I'm going to say thank you to Ian Hislop and Adam McQueen, and now hand over to the Meghan Markle of this podcast, who will be dubbed in later, Andrew Hunter-Murray.
Thank you, Helen. Now, we turn to the second half of this week's show, in which we're talking about power, unlimited power, and specifically unlimited solar power. There is a plan currently afoot to build an enormous new solar farm in Oxfordshire. It's going to be called the Botley West Solar Farm, and it's going to be absolutely huge. Sounds like an absolutely wonderful project, and as we all know, solar power is extremely necessary as the world tries to decarbonize as fast as possible. However, The Eye, particularly our correspondent Richard Brooks, who you've heard on this podcast many times before, has been looking into the details that lie behind Botley West Solar Farm, and particularly the companies and individuals which have made the proposals for it in the first place and their track record, and he's found some very interesting stuff indeed. I sat down with Richard to talk about Botley West, and I started off by asking him just how big this farm is going to be.
It's about 3,500 acres... which is 1,800 football pitches. Not that they are football pitches at the moment, but it's that's the size of it. Very picturesque if you've been there. Some lovely sort of sandstone-type villages. This solar farm is going to kind of surround a lot of these villages on land owned, or largely on land owned by the trusts that are owned for the benefit of the members of the family, has its seat at Blenheim Palace.
Yes, and are they the Marlborough family, descended from the Dukes of Marlborough? Well, they are still the Dukes of Marlborough, aren't they?
Yeah, the current Duke of Marlborough is James Spencer Churchill, formerly Jamie Blandford, the Marquis of Blandford, who has a bit of a colourful history. And the family's... sort of regular surname is Spencer Churchill, and the trusts that own this land are managed for the benefit of that family.
So weirdly, I was in the area recently. I was traveling through a lot of the villages that you have described, and there were a lot of banners and placards up all saying no to the Botley West solar farm. Now, you know, I know that there are various contentious things about exactly which bits of the country get big new developments. I have to say, I am in general enormously in favour of solar power, as I think quite a lot of people are. So what is it about this farm in particular that maybe is slightly more complicated?
Well, I think if you live there, the initial objection was that it just the scale of it and the dominance of it and the amount of the local countryside it's taking up. So, you know, you might have been very green, you might have been in favour of solar energy, but you might not have to have been too much of a NIMBY to say, look, this is going a bit far just here. Can we just, you know, have a sense of proportion? So a lot of people objected on those grounds. And of course, when we reported a bit more about the money behind the scheme, that was, in a way, music to their ears, because it wasn't just the effect on the local environment that may be a problem. It's kind of, where was all this money coming from?
Can you take us right from the beginning of which firms are behind it, and then who are the individuals behind those firms? Because it is fascinating.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of people you've never heard of. and actually, this looks to be a bit of a theme with solar development. Although we're extremely keen on it, just for a little bit more perspective, we need to, according to the Climate Change Committee, the government's Climate Change Committee, install about 30 gigawatts of the stuff by the end of the decade. And this particular solar farm would, so the developers say, generate about 840 megawatts, so nearly a gigawatt. So it's significant. It would be a significant contribution towards that. But it does appear that we are sort of just opening up to whoever comes along and says, look, I can give you a solar farm.
So the Marlborough family Their money is managed by a load of family trusts. Yeah. And those trusts have signed a deal with a firm called Photovolt Development Partners. Is that right?
That's right. That is a German company, and it is fronting for a particular UK company called Solar 5 Limited. This is the company in whose name the license has been given and will actually be legally responsible for the development and the funding of it. And this company is owned by a Cypriot resident Russian woman called Yulia Lezhen, of whom we know very little and certainly doesn't appear anywhere in connection with anything to do with solar farms.
Okay.
So the question is, you know, who is she? And how come she is going to, you know, develop 1,800 football pitches worth of solar farms? She, it transpires, is the wife of a Russian called Dmitry Glukhov, who is a Russian businessman who is alleged to have diddled, really, a major Russian bank.
Richard, is diddled a legally protected term in the UK, or is that...
I think I did those air quotes, so I think we're covered.
God. Oh, yeah, fine. Let the record show, Your Honour, the air quotes were used.
Lawyers will confirm.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, Glukhov.
He borrowed a lot of money from a Russian bank about 7 years ago or so to develop a goldfield in one of the outer regions of Russia. And according to some court papers filed in the US, there wasn't a lot of goldfield development going on. Hmm. What there was the diversion of the money that he borrowed into lots of other of his enterprises, shell companies, using his associates and so on. And those associates included his wife.
And who is the woman behind Photovolt?
This Solar 5 Limited. And those court papers that I was just mentioned, they say that she not only was she a front for him, but that companies including Photo Development and Solar 5 Limited were used to siphon off, in the words of the claimants in this court case, money that was owed to this bank or subsequently a kind of debt collection agency that it sold the debt to. So that appears to be where the money is coming from.
What implication does that have for the actual farm itself at Botley West? Because it is only at the planning stage at the moment, isn't that right? At the consultation stage.
That's right. And they put in a very long document listing all the benefits, but it doesn't say anything about who is behind it. You know, that is quite important.
So how do things proceed from here, given that these allegations have been raised by you? As in, has there been any response from Photovolt or from Solar 5 to your inquiries?
No, they haven't replied substantively. They've kind of dodged the questions. They pointed out that Ofgem has given them a licence, and they say that Ofgem did due diligence. Mm-hmm. Well, when you then get in touch with Ofgem, what you find out is they don't really do due diligence. They just do one or two basic checks, like the person hasn't been disqualified from being a director or whatever. They don't investigate people's backgrounds,
right,
like you might for a money laundering check or something like that. In fact, you'd have much more checks on you personally if you know when you buy a house, for example. So this just gets waved through, and then you can say, we have a license, what are you worried about? Now some of the local campaigners have gone back to Ofgem and said, come on, you've got to do better than this. For one thing, the license is in the name of Solar 5. Solar 5 is said to be owned by Julia Lejeune, when that's not really her name. Her name is Yulia Lezhen. So the application may well have been submitted on false information. That may negate it. We'll have to see, but that's one angle of complaint at the moment.
Is it right to say that Photovolt Development Partners or Solar 5 would be the ones who are making the money out of the farm, even if, you know, there's lots of new renewable energy being generated, they are the, they're the company who are going to be profiting from it in the end. And so that's why it's worth looking at their finances.
Yeah, face value, that is it. They would have to fund it. That, you know, it's not cheap to build a solar farm on this scale. So they've got to put their money up, and exactly where they're getting their money from is a bit unclear. We know that in the past they sold an interest in a solar farm in Japan, although that was some way before it had actually become a solar farm. The finances of the company are very complicated, using holding companies in Ireland, offshore companies with other interests, and assets get moved around, sort of shuffled around, and money sort of pops up. So the precise origins of the funding of this just aren't clear at all. What we do know, I mean, one other question that occurred to me looking at this was, well, you know, what about the financial situation of the Blenheim estate, the family trusts?
Presumably they stand to benefit a good deal from this proposed solar farm at Botley West being on their land.
Yeah, they will be picking up a lot of money, whether it's rent or whether it's royalties relating to the income that comes in, right, from the generation. We're not sure, but there'll be a lot of money in it for them. They look like they need the money, frankly. They've been borrowing money significantly over the last decade or so. They've now borrowed about £140 million. The family members have their own troubles. The Duke of Marlborough last year had his Porsche repossessed because he didn't keep up the repayments.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know, on his record book, that's kind of the least of his misdemeanors, frankly. But it does suggest that there's a bit of a problem here. One of the trustees of the trust, who is a chap called Edward Spencer Churchill, the half-brother of the current Duke. He lives in Monaco. He declares that he's a Monaco resident. The company through which he appears to hold a lot of his investments is also heavily indebted. So he could do with these trusts of which he is a beneficiary doing well. So what you might be seeing is a bit of an aristocratic cash flow problem. Just like, you know, 100 years or so ago, they'd used to, you know, marry an American or something to get some money in. Now maybe, you know, they're finding some Russian money to compensate.
Okay, so having found out this so far about Photovolt and about Solar 5 and about the Blenheim's trusts that are potentially standing to benefit, I mean, all the parties above standing to benefit, what do you think you're going to be looking at next? Because I imagine that you're going to stay with this story because it sounds very interesting and there's plenty more to unpack.
You know, we're not getting much more on where this money's coming from. I would have expected to hear a bit more. We might also have expected some reaction from another landowner that we haven't mentioned who's involved in this with a much smaller stake. I think about 5% of the land is owned by Merton College, Oxford University.
Oh.
So it's quite a strange... use for them to put their land to. Clearly, they're doing it for the same reasons, that it could be a money spinner.
Mm.
You know, it could be embarrassing for them too. The present warden of Merton, or I think she's acting warden, is a professor of corporate finance.
Okay,
Jennifer Payne. So she might, you know, be expected to be interested in where money comes from. And actually, her predecessor, the warden who signed off the project.
Mm.
Is now vice chancellor. You know, there's some people who really should be sort of asking a few questions here.
It sounds fascinating. It also sounds, and I'm not proposing things anything like this bad so far, it sounds a little like Teesside, the other story that you've been working on for many months now. It's an interesting confluence. I mean, there's not much public money involved here, but there's lots of private money and an unclear trail of where it's leading and who exactly the beneficiaries are going to be.
Yeah, I mean, there is public money in a sense, in that ultimately these people will get their money from bill payers. You know, there's a similar size kind of area, about 3,500 acres, and few checks. I mean, that seems to be the issue here, and I think it does pose some questions about the kind of race to decarbonise. You know, that we know we need to act quickly, but you've got to balance acting quickly with screwing it up, really. You know, and leaving it in the hands of the wrong people. You know, not to mention giving dubious money another home.
Richard Brooks there. Thanks to him and to Helen, Ian and Adam. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We will be back again soon with another one. Until then, the magazine remains available on newsstands. And if you go to private-i.co.uk and take out a subscription, you don't need to go to a newsstand because it will be delivered directly to your home. So do that. Tune in next time. This episode, as ever, was produced by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Thanks for listening.